Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Steve Martin. Steve is president slash CEO of Natural Encounters Incorporated, NEI, a company of over 50 professional animal trainers who teach animal training strategies and produce educational animal programs at zoological facilities around the world. Though best known for his work with free flight bird programs, most of his work involves teaching mammal caregivers the art and science of behavior change principles. He teaches several animal training workshops each year and is an instructor at the AZA Animal Training School, an instructor at the Recon Elephant Training Workshop, a trustee with the World Parrot Trust, and a recent member of the AZA Behavior Advisory Group. He is also president of Natural Encounters Conservation Fund Incorporated, a non-profit company that has raised and donated over $1.3 million to in-situ conservation programs. Steve Martin has a strong commitment to conservation and helping people understand their relationship with the living earth. The mission statement of NEI is connecting humans with the natural world, and Earth Day is an official holiday for all NEI employees. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Steve Martin to the ATA podcast show today. He's patiently waiting by in Florida, USA. Thank you, Steve, so much for coming and hanging out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Well, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for inviting me. Boy, it's a pleasure to be here. You know, I mean, I've heard about your work for a long time, and it's something that I was thought would be fun to do. And now here we are. We get to talk about animal training.
Yeah, and you're one of the big influences in my career back when I was in the zoo world as an employee. And my circle of influence, I would say, was a lot smaller back then than it is now. And you and Susan and Nick Bishop really just guided me for years. So on a personal note, I'm thrilled to be able to dive into my personal experience and the great mentorship and knowledge that you've shared with me. So thank you for that. And now I'm excited via the platform of this podcast show to share it with our audience. So let's dive in. Steve, yeah. I'd love for you to please take everyone listening back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training. And I know you're a great storyteller, so I'm excited for this. Share some stories with us from that time.
You know, it's so funny because, you know, thinking about that, I mean, if I think about going back to the start, then I think about the parakeet that I had when I was a kid. I had a little budgie, a little blue budgie named Perky. And I had to have been less than five, but that bird made such a great impact on me. But I remember that Perky would fly over to my hand and drink out of the cup that I was drinking out of. I would go out in the front yard and pick dandelions, and that was his favorite treat. So I know that I was using positive reinforcement then because I know that I would practice setting him down on the couch and him flying to my hand. But then, you know, I got involved with falconry when I was 16, many, many years ago. And of course, that's all about positive reinforcement. And for so many years, I learned so much about relationships with raptors and, You know, I realize now all the mistakes, maybe not all the mistakes, but I made a lot of mistakes with those guys. And I grew from those mistakes as I learned how to quit tricking those birds. I used to, if the hawk caught a rabbit, then I'd go off and try to catch another rabbit. And then I'd have the leg of the rabbit that it caught earlier, and I'd show it that rabbit piece to get him to come down, land on my glove. And I'd give him just a little bite of that rabbit leg and then put it back in my game bag. Well, of course, then a rabbit leg didn't mean, to the hawk, it didn't mean it's going to get a whole rabbit leg. It meant that at best, he's going to get a little tiny bite. And then we go off hunting. Well, there was a lot of things like that that I learned about baiting or luring and why to stop that. And most importantly, I learned that it's not important to catch more than one rabbit in a day. You know, I've flown lots of falcons, lots of hawks, and I got away from catching multiple head of game in any given day when I started realizing what an impact it was on the relationship I had with the birds. So, I mean, that was a huge turning point for me when I started focusing more on the relationship. So I quit holding jesses. So no longer do the birds sit on my glove and then go only when I want them to go. I took jess straps off so that they went whenever they wanted. If they want to sit in a tree, no problem. But I had such a great evolution in my thinking about relationships and positive reinforcement. I finally got to a point with Millie, and my hybrid falcon, and Taylor, another hybrid, and Mariah, my Harris hawk, that all of them, whenever they caught any game, they would sit there and wait for me to come up. And when I got there, they would step off politely and sit over there while I prepared the food, and I'd give them their favorite parts of heart and liver, and they'd hop up on the glove and back to the car we would walk without jesses on. And it made so much sense to me back then. And so I wanted all the falconers to know about this. And of course, everybody was still out trying to catch as much game as they could. So, that's really where I came from. I came from that bird of prey world, came from a lifetime of owning parrots as pets, which has changed a lot because I don't think they're really good pets for most people. Some people, but certainly not most people. But anyway, my falconry experience led me to setting up a show at San Diego Wild Animal Park way back in 1976. So I guess that was my beginnings, Brian.
I'm curious. I was talking to a mutual acquaintance of ours, Susan Friedman, recently, and she was talking about how we're working together on a project, and she was suggesting that we should reach out to you and ask some questions that we had for her. And she was saying that you and your mind have I can't remember the word you used. God, I wish I did. Like a latent database of information. Like you can look at something and you can see stuff that other people miss. And you kind of have a gut feeling about what's happening in a situation. And so I'm curious to hear, you're working with your hawks, your hybrid falcons, and learning about relationship. Now, a lot of people kind of go online and they might go to the content that you've got online, or they might go to Animal Training Academy and they watch a web class and they get all this information in their head. Was that the process for you? Were you kind of learning from mentors and books, or did you just come to these realizations through your own observations?
Yeah, I learned by all my mistakes. And, you know, the evolving focus that I had on welfare, although I didn't know the word welfare back then, but I identify it now as, you know, what I did trying to take better care of the animals and give them, basically it comes down to this, provide them an environment where they can use their senses and adaptations to earn a living, much like their wild counterparts. And by doing that, one of the things that I discovered was giving the animal a voice. Now, I talk a lot about it now in workshops and things. I didn't know about that particular angle, giving an animal a voice. But what I knew was that the animal's body language was really important. I could tell, if the bird was looking a certain direction, that there was something going on there. I didn't even have to be looking at the bird. I could be looking away, and I could tell that that bird had, there was something about the way it stood on my glove, and not the way it gripped my glove, just the way it felt on my glove. And I'd look over, and there he is looking up at an eagle overhead or something. But I've just been a student of body language all my life. These raptors, and then later parrots, you know, I found that their voice through their body language is as important as my voice. So that was a transition that I made early on in falconry, was giving the animal a voice. When the bird mantled over the game, that was its voice, you know, mantling, spreading its wings out to cover the food. That was its voice telling me it doesn't trust me. So my trust account with that bird was really low. And when I thought about it, I know that I was thinking that it's afraid I'm going to steal the food from it. And that's not right. That's not the relationship I want to have with any animal. And that's when I started letting the birds eat their entire fill every time they caught something. That's when our relationship transitioned to, instead of me being what some people might call the master of the bird, I became the partner of the bird. So we were equal partners. That falcon needed me just as bad as I needed her if we were going to catch the quarry. And we did it in such a, you know, such a natural way. So moving forward to today, you know, I guess, and Susan has said that to me a number of times about a latent database, and it's really about experience. It's about the experience that I've had that has built this sensitivity that I can sit there and see things other people can't see. Now, that's no magic or not pumping myself up. It's just that I've been around this a long darn time. And because I've been a student of body language and watch body language so much, I'm very sensitive to the little tiny things that the animal's body language tells me. And it helps me arrange those antecedent conditions, conditions before behavior occurs. And it also helps me arrange consequence conditions. So, but yeah, I mean, when I consult at a zoo or when I'm working with the trainers here, trainers are working with an animal and I'm sitting back watching, and I can see little tiny things that after the training session we can talk about and play back the tape, and then they can see it as well. You know, my goal is to help everybody be a great observer of body language and behavior. And so videotaping these training sessions is so important for that.
Yeah. And is that your main strategy of teaching this to others? Is videotaping and watching back to you? Because I know if we're saying observation is such a key skill, hi Phoebe Duck, then what is your what other tips can you give people to help them develop their own observation skills?
Well, you know, first of all, and you know, going back to Susan, I encourage people to learn more about the science of behavior change. So the science gives you a good foundation in how behavior works, that there's antecedent conditions that influence behavior, and there's consequence conditions that reinforce or punish behavior. And as good trainers, all we do is arrange antecedents and consequences. That's all we're doing as good trainers. So I start with that, learn more about reinforcement theory and what punishment, negative reinforcement is. And then focus on positive reinforcement. So when I go to a zoo or someplace else, I usually start with a lecture, some sort of symposium. We often will do workshops where people get involved with some training. And then I'll go out and coach, or just watch training and then give feedback, which, you know, it's a real art in giving feedback to people, because it's really all about building trust in a really short amount of time, sitting behind somebody training a tiger, let's say. And in order to have an effective talk down where people hear what I have to say, I have to make the environment safe. So safe by not criticizing anything that they do, recognizing that everybody is an individual. Like Susan has said many times, behavior is a study of one. And then finding a way to safely offer information. And the way I do it is I tell people that I've got information, if you're interested, some thoughts for you to consider. And if you like, I give information in the spirit of putting information on the table in front of you to, for you to consider. You don't have to pick it up and use it, but if it's interesting for you, I'm happy to help answer questions and help guide you through this information if that's what you want. But it's just as fine for me to see you leave the information there and go on about your own way, because maybe you'll consider it tonight or tomorrow and try something later. It's all about creating a safe zone where when people make mistakes, they don't feel bad that they made a mistake or embarrassed. They recognize that mistakes are simply an opportunity to start again with more information. So we backslap and high five mistakes instead of people going, oh crap, that was so bad. I'm all about, look at what we both learned. I mean, we learned what not to do again. And so let's change those antecedents, change those consequences, and get on with training and forget those mistakes. It's such an important part of consulting. Yeah.
So you want to make people not feel bad that they've made a mistake. And I'm curious, I see some trainers do a session, and if they make a mistake, they potentially focus on all of the things that went wrong, which is potentially the opposite of what we're trying to do with our animals. And then they focus on the end goal of what they're trying to train and all of the things that they still have to do moving forward. I myself am guilty of that. Is that part of, I'm curious, how do you train what you've just described to all of us? The ability to have a mistake and celebrate it effectively, I think is what you're saying. Can you talk more on this? In your words, how does one approximate themselves towards that?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because it's different with every person. So every zoo I go to and every person that I work with, it's different. So first of all, I have to build a trust account with the person. I have to have a conversation, find out a little bit about the person's history and their goals and what they want to train with this animal, and then sit back and watch from a distance and not be right over their shoulder, not give information in line while they're training, but wait till everything's finished and then go outside and talk about it, go away from the animal for sure. What's even better sometimes is to let them videotape themselves. So set up a camera where it's not a person looking over their shoulder. See, the part of the challenge is that people think that I or somebody else, a stranger, a curator, the vet, a director, is going to criticize anything that they do. So criticism is just not even part of it. It's for us, it's really just about sharing information. So if I were to criticize somebody for making a mistake with an animal, then all of a sudden my trust account with them is going to be bankrupt and they're not going to welcome me into their area again. So when I build a high trust account, we have commonalities, we understand the goals, and we talk about strategies to get to these goals. And then we pick a strategy that they like or that they think will work for them. And if they want, I'll help them. And if they don't want, if they want to try it on their own, I'm very happy for that too. But the talk downs afterwards is where you can really make progress in building the trust account. You know, it's just like training an animal. And humans are just another animal that we work with. When we're training whatever animal we're working with, I ignore wrong behavior and I reinforce approximations of behavior I want to see. So when somebody does something wrong, ignore it or change the antecedents and move on. But catch them doing some small approximation toward the right behavior. Focus on that. And when people go, oh man, it was such a problem that I always tell people problems are opportunities in disguise. That's all they are. Problems are there and mistakes are there to help guide us away from the things that we don't want to do again. That's how every species, every individual on this planet learns and grows. Their behavior evolves through making mistakes, trying again, different direction, a different thing. But so many people get paralyzed with fear about problems. You know, oh, it's going to be such a problem if somebody is standing over there talking while I'm trying to train this orangutan. Well, it's only a problem if you let it be a problem. Maybe it's an opportunity for this orangutan to learn to train, to generalize her behavior with other people around, standing around, strangers, veterinarians. It's an opportunity. It's not a problem. You know, a lot of people want to train in a vacuum. They want to control all the distractions so that they can have the perfect training session. Well, you can train animals that way, but you know, the reality is there's always going to be distractions. So when I train and around here at the ranch, and when I train at a zoo and work with people, I encourage people to train in chaos. So a cluttered environment, lots of distractions. And when an animal can learn to work with distractions, then all of a sudden their behavior, they are so resilient that they can do those behaviors anywhere. The vet team comes in, the director, a big dollar donor comes in, whoever, whatever, the animal's prepared for it. But not everybody thinks that way because they focus on the goal. And the goal is to have perfect behavior, whereas the process is more important than the goal. A lot of people focus on the goal when the process is what they miss. And the process is training behavior and then quickly generalizing that behavior to novel environments. And that prepares an animal to be a high performer in all these naive or novel situations that come up. It's a real art form for a lot of people because, you know, a lot of times people just want to check the boxes. You know, I did this, I bridged and I gave them food, and now I did that 20 times and I'm supposed to have this. There's a lot of box checkers out there because it feels good when you've checked all the boxes that you read in the book or the paper or heard from the trainer. But the problem is, you know, the animals, they're not box checkers, and their behavior is really, it's based on, their behavior is a reflection of the person's ability to train and a reflection of the antecedent conditions. So you can check all the boxes, but you can get nowhere in training. It's when you're really in sync with the animal, reading the body language, the animal's behaviors, telling you when to move forward, when to move back, what to reinforce and not. You know, that's part of the art. And it just takes a lot of time to learn the art of training.
I'm so glad we're talking about this, and you're making my job easy with regards to choosing a title for this episode. Problems are opportunities in disguise, training chaos, lots of great word sandwiches in there. Is it that you said that people are wanting to get that perfect behavior, but what's important is the process? Is it from a, if we were to ABA that, would it be that the reinforcer you see in trainers is that the animal does the thing that they're envisioning the animal doing in their head, versus they're getting reinforcement from applying the tools we have in a good way? So is it just about understanding your reinforcers, and maybe how do we move towards making the process reinforcing?
Yeah, and you know, here's part of the problem with that is the process is so reinforcing that people make slow progress. So shaping a behavior, every approximation, they stay there way too long because the animal did it without hesitation and they bridged and reinforced it and it felt really good to have that performance. And so you repeat it and you have the exact same performance, the exact same behavior, the exact same approximation. Where, and then, I mean, for instance, one person, a behavior manager at a zoo, said in a lecture that I was giving one time, she said to the team, well, we all know that it takes at least a year to teach a gorilla to accept an injection. And I didn't know what to say because I'm sure it takes her a year to teach a gorilla to do an injection. But I know that most gorillas can learn it in a week, maybe two, maybe four, depending on the animal and depending on the trainer. But it doesn't take a year. But when somebody says it's going to take a year, you will make it take a year. So here's the way I think about shaping behavior. Every step without hesitation. If the animal does this particular approximation, let's call it number one, without hesitation, hesitation, you go to approximation number two. If he does that without hesitation, you go to approximation number three. If at approximation number three, the animal hesitates, no problem. Go back to approximation number two, build a little behavioral momentum, and get going back to three and then four and five. You might even have to go all the way back to approximation number one, but you're never going to spend 5, 6, 8, 10 repetitions at any one approximation. Because every time you spend more than one approximation or more than one repetition at any one approximation, it's harder for the animal to move forward. The animal has to learn to keep moving forward through this behavior chain of approximations. And sometimes you got to go backwards. It's kind of like the tide coming in. We know the tide is coming in. It's always moving up the beach a little bit at a time. But some of those waves don't quite go as far as the others. But gradually, they're all going the same direction, and you're making progress with those waves as the tide creeps up the beach. It's the same with shaping, except that in a perfect shaping world, every step without hesitation, you move forward at the animal's pace. Now, rarely can we move forward every single approximation. But when it happens, it's a beautiful thing. You're training at the animal's pace. You know, I used to say, train fast, because animals can learn faster than you can train. And then online, I'm not on any social media, but people send me these things when my name pops up. And one of them was, Steve Martin says you should train fast. You should never train fast. You should train slow. And I'm going, wait a minute, my eyes are rolling back at my head. You can't train faster than an animal can learn, because you're not training anymore. The animal's not learning anymore. But when you train at the animal's pace, you set up the antecedent conditions, right? Well, the animal's going to learn fast. So consequently, when I'm training, teaching animals or teaching people, we tend to go really fast. It's very, very common when I go to a session at a zoo. It's very common that people walk out of there after we coached through this session and they went in and started again. We walk out with them with a big grin going, I had no idea the animal could learn that fast. But animals learn fast. Things that people take months to train usually should take a few days to train. But anyway, that's the process, is people get reinforced when they have an approximation that they can bridge and reinforce, and it makes them feel good. So they stay there. They don't take chances. They don't get outside the comfort zone, take a little bigger step or approximation. They stay in the safe zone where they're always going to get that reinforcer, being able to give that animal a treat and say, good boy.
And just letting you know, so you don't get concerned, I am conscious of the time. We are going to move forward, but you're just providing too much fodder for me. So I'm just going to stay here for just a little bit longer. So I'm really curious, if we're observing, you're observing trainers who are potentially staying in a spot for longer than might be beneficial to move the animal forward in a most positive, least intrusive way and still reach our end goal. How much for you is, and I don't even know if you think about this or if it's conscious for you or not, is like gut feeling versus logic? And like, do you sometimes, is your gut feeling and your logic sometimes conflicted? Or is it aligned? Do you see that in other trainers? I know that it's operationalizing.
But. Yeah, it goes back to that latent database, which is my gut feeling. I can watch behavior. I can watch training and get a feel for how a change would be beneficial. It's a gut feeling, an instinct, a latent database. Many or most people don't see that. It just takes a lot of experience, a lot of observational skills. And again, I've been doing this most of my life, right? Like 50 years. So I don't expect everybody to be able to see those little tiny antecedent conditions or those changes that might be so helpful. But I try to help people learn them. It's a gut instinct for me. And when I'm training, I train fast. You know, we just did some tech talks here, and I trained a couple goats and I trained a couple ravens that do behavior on cue there in one session in 2 or 3 minutes that, you know, for most people, they're looking at that going, holy cow, I didn't know a goat could learn that so fast, or a raven or a parrot could learn that. But they can when you keep up with the animal and you're always focused on moving through the approximations, moving ahead, rather than just focus on this small goal and stay there at that goal, like we said.
And I've been witness to a whole collection of animals rolling up in a new location and being trained in a very short period of time to perform in front of thousands of people when you were super generous and facilitated me coming over and working with you and the NEI team in 2012 at the State Fair of Texas and the Birds of the World show. And I was in an element that I hadn't found myself in before, where I was just watching all of this, what you've just described to the podcast audience, unfold, and all of these animals being trained super quickly. And one thing you said that I remember is we're sitting in the back area before everyone goes and does their tasks for the day, and you said, I don't aim to be the smartest person in the room. I just surround myself with people that are way smarter than me. And that is stuck with me to this day. And I just wanted to use this opportunity, selfishly, sorry, podcast audience, to get you to talk to that. Can you, in your words, why did you say that back then? Why is that important to you?
You know, it was important to me then as it is now. Maybe because it wasn't important to me back in the day. Back in the day when I set up a show at the Wild Animal Park, it was really successful. I was there for 4 years. A super successful show. It was the first free flight multi-species bird show in the country. And, you know, this is 1976. So, and it took off with great acclaim. So it went to my head. I mean, I really thought, hey, I'm pretty special here. And the people working with me on the team, of course, back then, I thought they were working for me. And so after every show, I would stay out there and take all the credit. People would come up and shake my hand and say, great job, slap me on the back. And I'd get all the credit for the whole show. Where really, it was a big team effort, you know, and everybody there participated. Well, a guy named Chuck Rolls worked for me then. He finally quit, and he just up and quit, waving his finger in my face, yelling at me what a jerk I was, and told me all these things. And it really affected me. And this is 1978. So after he left, I had a conversation with Gary Santolo, the other guy there, and a couple other people there. And, you know, I just came to the realization that this show isn't me. This show is us. It's a team. And I relied on them. Those people were amazing people. God, they were so creative and wrote half the lines in the show. So anyway, I started bringing them out after every show. I started letting them do parts of the show, which was amazing. I mean, for the first 2 years, I did every show every day for 2 years, wouldn't let anybody else do it. So, and I just came to the realization the show is better with them doing it. So I continued on from there. And then I started realizing, as I did surround myself with really smart people and built my company up to where we had many, many amazing people, I started realizing that it really takes amazing and incredibly smart and talented, creative people to do the things that I want to do with this company. So now more than ever, I am so humbled by the people that I work with. And I don't miss a moment to say that I am always not the smartest person in the room. I have one thing that's made me good, and I have that latent database that Susan talked about. I have that ability to look at behavior, look at animals, and make decisions that are often helpful in training. I'm not reading their minds or anything. I just said, I can make some decisions that are often helpful. A lot of times they're not. But that's what I'm good at, man. That's my strong suit. There are so many other things I'm not good at, like organizing so many of the things that we do in this company, especially now with this growth spurt that we're in the middle of in this horrible pandemic. We're growing this company of all things. Well, I've got other people around me who are so much better at it. This company would be so limited in who we are and what we do without the other people around me. So I don't forget that for a minute. It's so important.
Wonderful. So glad we got to talk about that as well. Hey, we're going to talk about the exciting stuff you're doing now. I'm going to grab one more opportunity before we push on, because we've got some other stuff we wanted to cover in today's episode. But when I was in, we met in 2010 in Brisbane, Australia at the Parrot Conference, a great conference.
Oh, yeah.
And I had no idea who someone who had mentioned already today, Susan Freeman, was at that time. But I had this ethos that I tried to live by. And I think I kind of remember, like, I feel like I was annoying you because I was just pounding you with so many questions. But my thing was meet the people that inspire you, find out what they've read, who they learn from, and then go read and learn from all of those people. So, hey, I can attribute, I know the podcast listeners of this show know that I'm a fan of Crucial Conversations. Everyone, that's Steve Barton's ripple. And I said to Steve, I said, who's your biggest influence? And he said, Susan Freeman. And earlier in this chat today, you said all we're doing is changing antecedents and consequences. So you were observing and you were learning from mistakes, as you suggested earlier. How important was meeting Susan and adding to that, building on what you're already doing with the science? Like, how did that change you as a person?
Yeah, it was a really important time for me. You know, and I say many times, and I've told Susan this, I was always a good trainer. You know, I was probably one of the best trainers I knew at that time, all the time, growing up before I met Susan. I knew how to train birds. I did shows. I was a behavior guy on the California Condor Recovery Team. So I had made a name for myself training birds. But then when I did, there was an online course that Susan contributed to, and she was talking about parrot behavior. And I looked at this stuff and I'm going, God, this makes such great sense. And so I emailed her privately and I said, who are you? How did you learn this? And so we started chatting back and forth and learned all about, you know, applied behavior analysis and who she was and working in the human world, but like the, she worked with delinquent kids and things like that, but really liked animals, and she had a parrot or two. And so the more I got to know her, the more impressed I was. And I was doing, at the California Condor Recovery Team, there's 12 or 11 core members at that time. And we have, once a month, we have a conference or a meeting, and we invite public and stuff. So I was going to be talking about behavior and about training and condor behavior. And so I invited Susan to come give a talk. And she gave a talk that just blew people away. That's the first time I ever met Susan. And she came and talked about the science of behavior change principles. And I remember one of the condor team guys pulled me off on the side and said, he was one of the head guys. And he said, Steve, do you think Susan would be interested in joining the team? I looked at him and smiled. And I said, I don't know. We could ask. So we went and asked her, and she was very happy to join. So I think she was on the condor recovery team with us for probably 10 years or more. But every time I saw Susan speak or work with her in our workshops or sit here in my kitchen having a beer with her, I learned so much. And it's so much. I mean, here's the thing. Here's what helped me most. When I heard Susan talk about the science, about detrimental side effects of negative reinforcement and punishment, and about the science of behavior change in general, it caused me to start thinking about the things that I did. So I was doing bird shows then. I had jesses on birds. They'd fly down. A hawk would land on my hand. I'd wrap up the jesses, and I'd talk all about the hawk, a bunch of natural history information or other stuff. And the hawk would bait or try to fly off my hand. I never really realized what an impact that had on my relationship with the bird. But when Susan talked about detrimental side effects of negative reinforcement and punishment, one of those is avoidance behavior, that the animal will avoid you in the future. It helped me understand that, hey, this bird isn't going to fly back to my hand because in the past, I've grabbed his jesses at this point. So I quit holding jesses. So it's those kind of things, you know, I mean, it's made me better able to plan training plans or create training plans, better able to set up those antecedent conditions and also arrange my consequences so that they have better lasting effect. And, you know, there's a lot of science stuff that I've learned from Susan that, again, I'm not the smartest guy in the room for sure, but I don't remember all these terminologies. But I tell you what, I've been practicing these things for a long time. And it's not important to me to make sure everybody knows the science, but it's important to me that everybody knows Susan. So when they go to Susan's website or take LLA, that's going to help them understand more about the science. But when I'm coaching somebody at a zoo, they don't have to, you know, repeat back to me the matching law or contra freeloading, any of those things. I don't really care. What I care about is their connection with the animal and reading body language and arranging those antecedent conditions. So, but Susan will help everybody plan better and become a better trainer. Now, Susan and I consulted zoos often, and, you know, we can sit there and watch a training session, and we'll walk away and have a conversation. And this is where Susan talks about my latent database that, you know, some the things that I say, and often there's a list of things that I notice, small changes that can be made. These are things that Susan acknowledges that I see that she doesn't. But I'll tell you what, she's getting pretty darn good at that stuff. Yeah.
It's important to me that everyone knows Susan. I'm into that. I think people are listening to this show and have been in one of those talks of Susan where the room's been blown away.
Yeah.
Now, under normal circumstances, and as mentioned in your bio that I read out at the start, you spend a large amount of time traveling. Can you share with everyone what your work entails when you're traveling to various places? If someone is listening to this show and they want to hire Steve Martin to come and assist with their project, what is the scope of work you find yourself doing?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. You know, the world's changed now, so I suspect my travel schedule is going to change. But, you know, up until this pandemic hit, I was out of town typically 200 days a year. And much of that is consulting at zoos. So a zoo would call me up, hire me to come out, do a workshop, set up a program, coach trainers and things. If we're setting up a full behavior management program, I might be there 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and I might leave Chris or Ari, people that you know, behind, and they'd work on it. And I'd come back 1 week a month or something. We also, when we set up a show, when we open a show, like at the State Fair of Texas, I would be, well, now at the State Fair, I'm there only for about 2 weeks. I'm there to help set it up, and I'm there in the beginning. That's what my new contract is. But, you know, for 25 years, I was there at every show, and that was my contract. For 24 days, I had to do every show 4 times a day, which I loved doing. But now I've got great people on the team who are doing those shows, and they are spectacular. So, when I go travel, I not only go coach people at zoos, but also I go see wildlife. I mean, I love traveling to see nature. I go to Africa once, sometimes twice a year, Alaska usually twice a year, and it's all photographing and videotaping natural behavior. So it's predation in Tanzania, watching cheetah stalk and chase gazelle. We'll sit with one cheetah and a couple cubs for all day long, have back lunch, and just follow them and learn about cheetah or learn about that pride of lions. In Alaska, we're videotaping humpback whales, bubble net fishing in Ketchikan, bears. We have a couple different places where we go bear viewing, where we can sit with bears all day long when they catch salmon just 50 feet away, 100 feet away. Some unbelievable video and photos come from that. But most importantly, great knowledge. You know, I've been able to use the knowledge that I've gained, the experience I've gained watching bears catch salmon to help design bear exhibits, brown bear exhibits at a couple different zoos. So it's really helpful to be able to get out in nature and watch animals. So I love doing that. But now the consulting thing, I don't know how much I'll be on the road. We are opening a virtual consulting program now where we can do watch videotapes. We can do lectures remotely. I mean, Zoom has just, you know, the ability to communicate so effectively over the internet like this is really going to change the way consulting goes for me, I think. So we'll start doing more and more of that now. We're already talking with a couple of zoos about it.
It's exciting. And as you've alluded to, and as this is a result of 2020, is not normal circumstances. But you talked before about opportunities. And so you and your team, like so many of us, have had to pivot what you do and how you do it. And we've got the feeling, I think, as the podcast audience, that you love traveling. You love working with people. You love doing all of the things that you've talked about so far. And I'm sorry, you know, that the situation's meant that these things aren't possible in the present moment for you. However, if there was to be a silver lining, your team has seemingly most definitely found it, because ATA members have been buzzing with all the new online offerings from NEI Tech. Can you talk us through some of the new opportunities that you're providing?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that opening. You know, back in January, well, actually, way back in October, November last year, I started realizing that we need a new building. We need a building that's going to be the new home for all of our workshops. And we're going to expand our workshops. We're going to do bigger, better workshops, different species. We're going to do corporate retreats here, where people from big corporations can come out and learn about the science of behavior change and work with some animals and stuff. So we designed a building last year, and it's the ultimate. I mean, this building is phenomenal. It's going to be the ultimate workshop building. So anyway, we then opened Natural Encounters Training and Education Center. That's what the building was going to be. So back in about December, I started realizing, you know, we ought to do these online courses. And we talked to Susan a little bit about it. So we came up with the idea, because I'm so passionate about ambassador animals and the way they're trained and handled. And, you know, I spent a lot of years on the Animal Welfare Committee at AZA. So welfare is always front of my mind and one of my passions. And so I saw room for growth in ambassador animal areas when it comes to welfare and training. So I convinced the rest of the team, which it didn't take much convincing. You know, I just had a meeting with them and launched this idea, and everybody loved it. So we launched it. So we did an ambassador animal course, 4 weeks. And every night, Eastern time from 7 until 9 o'clock, lectures and 30 minutes of Q&A. But most importantly, we provided the opportunity for our team to be a mentor to anybody in the course. So we had a lot of people in this course. Each one of them who wanted a mentor had actually not one, but two mentors who they could communicate every day if they wanted, by Zoom or by phone or email, to work through their problems, to watch the videos and help them with their ambassador animals. God, it was so successful. It was really crazy. And then as we're getting ready to start this course, I think it was Ari Bailey on my team who said, we should do more lectures. We should do these talks every day, because we're sitting around the house. You know, we have time. We should share our information. So that's how we came up with the Tech Talks, Training and Education Center Talks. And they're, you know, I mean, they've been super successful. I think we're in week 10 starting this next, right now in this week. But yeah, we pick a subject to talk about, like trust. It was Trust Week, all about trust. This week is the hierarchy, most positive, least intrusive, effective methods, by Susan Friedman. Ken Ramirez is going to be speaking on Wednesday, and then a panel on Friday, which is our basic format. So this thing has really taken off. We've got, man, it's really great. We have a lot of followers. And just yesterday, we announced a new course coming up. And this is going to be parrots. So there's a lot of people with companion parrots, a lot of people that work with parrots in education programs, zoos, and other places, who want to know more about training parrots, managing and training parrots. So our parrot course is going to start June 3rd, and it'll go every Wednesday evening, starting June 3rd. And people can get mentors there too, where somebody can be with them every day if they want, over the phone or over the Zoom meeting, and help them through their challenges with parrot behavior.
It sounds amazing. And can I ask, because by the time this podcast comes out, I know people are going to be going, when's again Ramirez and Susan Friedman talking? And it's going to be finished by the time the podcast is released. So can people then go watch replays, and how do people do that?
Yeah, absolutely. All of these are available in our library. So the Tech Talks you know, we do an hour of lecture and 30 minutes of Q&A, Monday and Wednesday. So Susan was Monday, Ken is Wednesday, and then on Friday, we do an hour and a half of panel discussion. Now, all of those then go into the library. Now, people pay to come live. They pay $25 a week, which is nothing. It's like $8 for the hour and a half lecture. And they're in the library. So anybody can go scroll through the library of tech talks and see what they want to catch up with. But yeah, the Susan Friedman and Ken Ramirez one will definitely be in the library.
And everyone can access this from the write-up for this episode on the Animal Training Academy website. We'll link to all of this. Or you could head to www.naturalencounters.com and find the big NEI Tech button. Have you got anything to add to that with regards to where people can jump online to connect, or just do as I just suggested?
Do what you suggested. And there's a lot of great information there.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Steve. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we like to call them. So very grateful for that. Now, yesterday when preparing for this episode and reading your bio, I was super impressed by the $1.3 million that the NEI Conservation Fund has raised for in-situ conservation. And on the Conservation Fund website, and as we mentioned in your bio, it talks about connecting humans to the natural world, which I thought related really nicely to something that you told me last week was really important to you in the work that you do. And this is inspiring caring that leads to conservation action. And when we caught up to discuss the topics for this episode, you mentioned that your thoughts on this have continued to be built on and evolved over time. Can you share with the audience what this means for you, how your thoughts have changed over time, and also how the ethos gets practically applied with the work that you and NEI do?
Yeah, you know, way back when I first started doing programs in 1976, that show at the Wild Animal Park, it was mostly birds of prey, various types of raptors and some parrots. So I wanted people to know as much about raptors as I did and care as much. And I thought through knowing would cause caring. So I went to the natural history books. I learned all I could about a red-tailed hawk and everything. And I went out and sort of regurgitated all that natural history information about their eyesight and their pressure in their feet and, you know, their bootios built for soaring on. And it was really boring information. I mean, I look back now and I can't even believe we kept people in the seats. But then later on down the road, I started realizing more and more about the environment and how we have an opportunity to affect change, that it became more important to me to not just educate people. And education was never a really good word for me. I never did that well in school. You know, I mean, I didn't go to college or anything. Well, I was in college, a month or something. I wanted to be a game warden, so I was taking police science, and that didn't last very long. But my calling back then, of course, was birds. And so instead of college, I went and pursued falconry, and I was working with a bird vet. So anyway, the more I learned about how I have an important opportunity to influence people's behavior, and I started realizing more and more about the things that we do in our program, and it became more serious to me that we do have an opportunity to influence people. So I changed from wanting to educate people. I wanted to inspire people. And we inspire people through carefully designed programs with close encounters and memorable experiences and carefully choreographed routines and charismatic presentations that engage people and empower people. So, I went the next step, and I wanted that inspiration to lead to action so that I want people right now to make a difference right now. Because I go consult at shows sometimes, and I see people doing a great job with a lot of cool behavior and a really charismatic presentation. And then all of a sudden they go, well, I hope you enjoyed our show. Enjoy your day here at the zoo. Bye. And people walk away going, God, I wish I knew how I could help. I really like those animals. So we came up with this idea a lot of years ago that right then we give people an opportunity to make a donation. And that donation is going to go right to the field. No overhead costs. Nobody gets a salary out of that or anything like that. The very first year we did it at the state fair, We promoted the Javan Rhino program in Ujung Kulon in Indonesia. Javan Rhino is one of the, if not the rarest mammal in the world, 60 or so alive in the whole world. And none in captivity, fortunately. They're all in the wild. Well, I learned about Ujung Kulon and Javan Rhinos from a guy named Ron Tilson at Minnesota Zoo. And I sat there all afternoon talking to him about this program. And he told me that, you know, these rhinos are the flagship species. They're really important because they're so rare. Nobody ever sees them. We know they're there. And a couple camera traps have caught them, and we see their footprints. He said, but, you know, we don't need Javan rhinos. What we need is that forest. We need the silver-leaf monkeys in that forest. We need the biodiversity in that forest. So it's fortunate that we have Javan rhinos that we can fly the flag for and get everybody excited. So that year at the State Fair, 24 days at State Fair, we raised money by just having a raven take bills out of people's hands and standing on a plastic box and shoving these bills in the box. We raised over $20,000 in 24 days. And all that money went straight to Ujung Kulon. They bought the wardens a boat, which they sorely needed for the poachers, and they bought them radios, which also they needed. So right there, the people in Dallas were helping to not just save Javan rhinos, but save nature in this huge, beautiful park called Ujung Kulon in Indonesia. Well, that felt so good to me that we just couldn't stand it. And we continued doing it over and over and found better ways to raise money with two ravens or three ravens or a raven and a Kia and a raven and a macaw raising money. And it just went on and started selling shirts and things. And we got to where we were raising, oh gosh, at the State Fair, $50,000 or $60,000. And again, every penny goes right to the field. So we've supported so many great programs, all in situ conservation programs, usually small programs that the big conservation organizations aren't supporting. So people that really need the money. And it's just so rewarding. And it's funny, too, when we go do a show at a zoo, let's say Denver Zoo, we go to Denver Zoo to do a show. I make a deal with the director and I say, we'd like to raise money here. And here's how we do it. And I show them photos or video. And so we want to partner with you on this. We want to give you half the money that we raise. So you just tell us what program you want the money to go to, and you know, we'll promote it that this is one of your great conservation programs. I've had two zoos fight me on it and not want me to raise money. They say, no, I want it to go to our general fund. And I say, wait, this has got to go to conservation. I'm telling people this money is going to help nature, help wildlife, and it's going to go right to the field, every penny of it. And it can't go to your general fund. Well, then you can't do it. Oh my gosh, it was just such irrational thinking. Here they have free money for their conservation program. But anyway, both zoos finally, through a number of meetings, they both came around and finally gave us an opportunity to identify a species that the money would go toward. But it's a wonderful thing. We still do it. We do some shows different places now that won't allow us to raise any money just because they don't want, you know, they already hit up their guests for enough money, and they don't think raising money at our show would be in line with their way of thinking for the guest experience. But yeah, we love doing it.
I remember the, I think it was IKEA in Dallas was the first.
Yeah. Kia, beautiful, you know, IKEA.
Even
He's off at a breeding program right now.
Oh, nice. It was a strange experience coming to Dallas, having worked in Australia for a long time and seeing a palm cockatoo for the first time.
in Dallas.
Working with a trained Kia in a program for the first time rather than just in a breeding program. I remember that year someone came up and they handed you a check for the conservation project, and it was substantial.
We had one guy who used to donate $100 for every year we were there at the show. So, you know, one check was $1,800, and the next year it was $1,900. So, and then we had another guy that would come up, and he'd just put $300 or $400 in the raven's mouth. And, you know, we had a really good following there at the State Fair. Yeah.
And so when you think about inspiring care and that leads to conservation action, does that bleed into other components of what you do, or is it mainly about the amazing work that you're doing, collecting money after the shows?
Yeah, we really hope that it flows over into other parts of their life too, that they'll go home and maybe become a member of the zoo or a conservation organization, maybe start recycling because they didn't know how important or effective it could be to help save nature. You know, maybe just caring for the environment in the way they handle chemicals around the house or the things that they purchase.
Awesome. And thank you for sharing all of that. We are sadly at the final question for this episode. In the podcast audience, I know they provide me feedback all the time. They're like, no, keep going. I have a million questions I can ask you, but we're going to move towards the end and we're going to direct you to where you guys can go to learn more from Natural Encounters and Steve Martin online. But Steve, for this part of our episode, we started off when you were, 6 years old with your pet parrot. And we've talked about the amazing things that you're doing in 2020 and over the last few years. We want to end then and looking forward. So can you please take the listeners of this show into the future now and share with them what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the umbrella animal training world?
Yeah, you know, I recently published a paper on that, oddly enough, and I presented it at the IMADA conference when they were with the AZA conference. So anyway, the title of the paper, it's on our website at Natural Encounters. The title of the paper is The Future of Zoos Through the Eyes of a Dreamer. So it talks to Walt Disney had a famous saying about him being a dreamer, and that's what really helped him move his career forward, always thinking of things outside the comfort zone. And I've always been that guy too. I was always in a place where I'm dreaming about what's next, bigger and better. And, you know, your question, what do I want to see in the zoo world in the next 5 or 10 years? It fits right into that paper. So really, I think, and aside from the paper and very personally, you know, I want to see people become better trainers to begin with, people in zoos to know more about the art and the science and the skill of animal training, because that's where welfare is for animals. I'm all about welfare. So unfortunately, training is just taking hold. Now, it's been around for a long time, but people are just now starting to recognize over the last 5 years, maybe 10, that training is a key and essential point in welfare, animal welfare. Teaching animals to voluntarily participate in their own healthcare is just the most important thing that's happened to animals, I think. You know, a lot of people are focused on enrichment, and enrichment has been through a big evolution over the last 30 years or so. Well, animal training is doing much the same thing. It's evolving right now, and people are putting more focus on positive reinforcement training. But I go farther than that. In order for that to happen, for people to be better trainers, we have to have better managers. We have to have a safe zone where people are comfortable making mistakes. You know, there's so many people that I go talk to at zoos who don't train. And these are people who've been around 10 years, 15, 20 years. And they say things like, why fix it if it isn't broken? Or it's always worked before. Well, it's always worked before, and you never knew it was broken because you never knew there was a better way. You were never looking through the welfare lens. You're always looking through the goal. Get the animal out on the exhibit, get the animal back inside. Get the animal out with a cold hose if that's what you take. Get the animal back inside with push boards if that's what it takes. And teaching animals to voluntarily participate in their healthcare was never a thought back then. But now it's not just a thought, it's becoming the new standard. But people sometimes are afraid to train because they don't know how to do it. It's something brand new. You've been in the zoo world for 20 years. All of a sudden, somebody, your curator says, hey, you got to start training animals next week because we just wrote it into your job description. And people go, holy cow. It's like, It's like maybe like bowling. Your boss comes up to you and says, "Hey, Ryan, next Friday, we're in a bowling league now with the museum. We're going to be bowling against a museum, and you're on the team. So see you at the bowling alley Friday night." Well, some people would go, "Yeehaw, I love bowling." And some people would go, "Holy crap, I don't know how to bowl. I've never bowled before." Well, that's the same with training. Some people go, "Oh, yeah, man, I love it. I read the book and I'm ready." And some people just go, "Wait, I have no idea, and I'm surely going to fail." People are so afraid to fail that they don't try. They're paralyzed with fear, so they don't try. So we have to create a safe environment where when they try and fail, we support and reinforce that that try, that behavior. And we have to help people know that that failure is just an opportunity to start again with more information, like I said earlier. When people will start training and making mistakes, learning from mistakes and growing, then they're going to move welfare forward. When they get good coaching, you know, it's like playing basketball. Here's a good story. A zoo called me in. The zoo chairman of the board called me and encouraged the zoo to hire me because they have a behavior management program and they have a pretty well-known behavior consultant. And she set up a whole program there and everything, and they had a certification. So the chairman of the board wanted to know just how good this program is. So they hired an outside consultant, me, to come in. So I sat with them and I talked to the board members and the director and the director of animal care. And so we decided that over 3 days now, I'm going to go watch all the training. So I went and watched all the training. And I came back and had a meeting with the board and directors and everybody. And the chairman of the board said, "Well, Steve, what did you find? Where do we rank?" And I said, "You know, it's kind of hard for me to say, but maybe let me make an analogy here. When kids grow up in the front yard throwing a basketball at the hoop, they learn to get it in every once in a while. And the more they practice, the more they get it in the hoop. And when they practice a lot, they get pretty good. And then they go to grade school and they can practice there. And some of those kids that practice a lot in their front yard, some of them just had natural inclination. Some of them had to work really hard. But a few of them got a chance to play on the high school basketball team. And that's where they got their first good coaching. And then they learned the strategies. They learned the science. They learned a little bit about the technique and things. And they practiced more and they got better at it. And a very, very few of them got to go to college and play basketball in college. That's where they had great coaching. That's where they really learned the science, the strategies, and improved their skills. And, you know, such a minor, tiny little fraction of those people got to go to the professional levels. And they are the top. So I said, with that in mind, that is background. I said, overall, your trainers here at the zoo are in high school. You know, they've done well in their front yard throwing the basketball, and they've had some coaching in high school, and they're doing a pretty adequate job for that level. But there's still college and professional levels ahead, so you've got a long ways to go. And it set them back a little bit. But, you know, when I go to zoos, that's kind of the analogy I use because I see the potential to have great training in zoos. I mean, amazing training in zoos, but everybody's still in grade school or high school level. There are a few college level and even a few professionals out there. But for the most part, it's at a pretty even level and getting better as more coaching, more resources are out there, you know, places where people can go get information. They're learning more and hopefully they're practicing more with some new strategies that are going to help them be more successful. So that's what I'd like. In order for people to improve, they need the resources, they need the coaching, they need a safe zone where they can make mistakes. They need directors and curators and veterinarians that will support them when they make mistakes and get them the coaching, the resources and things that it takes to get to the next level. That's what I want.
And does this... I'm going to throw some thoughts at you and you can say, "Hey, Ryan, that's not what I was trying to say," or you can resonate with it. Is this educating those people on behavior? Because I'm assuming if someone's in grade school and they get asked to go train or revive, get asked to go bowl, and the reinforcers, as we talked about earlier, often are those final behaviors, and the trainers are going to go and not know what to do and not get those final behaviors. Is it, do the managers need an understanding of behavior to understand that there might be a lack of reinforcement available for those trainers to go and implement these programs they're trying to get them? Is it needed?
Yeah, it is the science needed? Is grad school needed? The best trainers I know are not necessarily ones with science degrees. I do know a couple of people that have degrees in applied behavior analysis, and you know, which is for me, which is the right education if you want to be a trainer. Applied behavior analysis is where you start. There are other areas of psychology that don't prepare you like that. But there's people who've graduated master degrees and even PhDs that are hopeless in training, the application of the science. They're a great scientist, but they're not a great practitioner. In order to be a great practitioner, I think that people, first of all, the more science they understand, the better they're going to be able to plan and structure their training sessions and things. But to be a great practitioner, you need a lot of experience. You need experience and maybe it's an empathy, latent database and empathy that allows you to sort of get a feel for what's going on in the animal's head, even though I profoundly always say that nobody knows what an animal's thinking. Well, I used to think that I did. I don't. I think nobody does. Even the person who charges you a lot of money to read your dog's mind, that person doesn't know either. But I think that the more you can read the animal's body language, and you give that animal a voice through that body language, the better trainer you're going to be. And so all the science in the world is not going to help you learn to read body language. It's really about you getting in there and starting to train the animal and listening to the animal's body language, which is an interesting concept, I think. But the more science you have will help you interpret some of the behaviors that you see and be able to arrange those antecedent conditions and avoid aversive stimulus and help you realize that if an animal is moving away from you, there's a punisher or a negative reinforcer in the environment. And what is it? What's the function of that behavior? And figure out that function so that you can change the antecedents and the consequences. But yeah, I think that the science is good, but the science doesn't make you a good trainer. So the best trainers are the ones who have both. They know the science and they're a great practitioner because of years of experience watching animal behavior.
I love it. And if you want to surround yourself with good teachers and instructors, then start a podcast show because I get to hang out with people like Steve Martin all day. And if you want to see the result of the basketball metaphor, I'm watching the Michael Jordan documentary on ESPN at the moment. I don't know if anyone else out there is watching it, but that is a sensational, potentially great way of appreciating the metaphor that Steve just shared with us. So people are so afraid to fail so they don't try. I'm not sure if the listeners of this show, I don't know if I became muted as my dog Phoebe's just jumped in between my voice and my mouth and the microphone. I'll talk around here. Thanks for the licks, Phoebes. So the growth mindset, I don't know if you've read that, Steve. Have you heard of the growth mindset?
No. No, I'm not even sure what you said there. I think Phoebe was talking.
The growth mindset.
The growth mindset. No, I haven't read it or heard of it.
And
I will write it down.
You called yourself a dreamer. When you said that, I was reminded of another famous person that I'm sure the podcast audience know, and that is Steve Jobs. And they did an advertisement for Apple back in, I think, the 80s, where they said, "He who thinks he's crazy enough to change the world are the ones who do." Does that resonate with your thinking, Steve? That's the feeling I'm getting.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never thought about changing the world, although I guess I do often think that I have a great power of influence on some people, not all, that it's with that opportunity comes responsibility. So because I have a format that engages people and I have a platform that's so important to animal welfare that, you know, I just hope that that opportunity holds true, that I can actually do some good in changing people's behavior and help them learn more about animal training and learn more about their connection with the natural world. So Awesome. And by the way, just one more thing. Just circling back, I forgot to tell you about the that Disney quote. Walt Disney, the quote that I love so much. Walt Disney said, first think, second believe, third dream, and finally dare. We have people who think about the current situation. We even have people that believe that they have the power to make change. And I've always been a believer. I've always been a thinker and a believer. And then dream is the third one. Disney was a huge dreamer. I've always been that dreamer. And I've always believed that I can accomplish things that I set out to do. I've always believed that failure is just an opportunity to start again. But finally, the last one is dare. Disney dared to make mistakes. I mean, he was out there doing it and failing right and left. You know, he was fired from his job at the newspaper for lack of creativity, believe it or not, when he was young. He started 11 companies and they all failed until finally he happened on to Mickey Mouse, Mickey and Minnie Mouse. So think, believe, dream, and dare. We need more people who can dream. And we need an environment where those dreams can be realized by people taking a chance, getting outside of their comfort zone and making mistakes and learning from it, daring to fail. We need people to dare. And, you know, that's what's going to move this community and this zoo profession forward. People who can dream about new things, new ways to provide better welfare and better training for animals and things. And then dare to make a change. Dare to step out there even though you might fail. That's what we need.
Not that I dared to add to a quote. It's so beautiful and from someone who did change the world. But maybe we could be embarrassed onto the end of that, because I'm thinking about you sharing that some zoo professionals that you've had relations with have kind of gone, but if it's not broken, why fix it? And I'm thinking of you saying earlier in this episode that when you think back to the things you used to say about natural history in an educator role to the audience, you kind of go, you know, that's not really that interesting. And someone said a quote to me, and I think it was Hannah Brannigan, the dog trainer, who said this, is you should be embarrassed when you look back at what you used to do. And if you aren't, you're not growing.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like it. Hey, yeah, it's true.
Thank you so much for sharing everything today, Steve. We've already mentioned this, but just to remind everyone listening, if they want to learn more and get in touch with you and the team, the best place to do this would be at naturalencounters.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's the best place.
Wonderful.
And Ryan, thanks so much for having me on. You know, this podcast you do, ATA, is such an important thing for animal people. And I hope more people will find their way here, and you'll have more opportunity to influence more people about animals and training. It's just so important. So thank you for everything you've done.
Well, thank you. That means a lot. And you know, the podcast show is so reinforcing for me as an individual. And then I get to create ripples. It's just a bonus. And as a result of so many failures, this is just the thing that worked.
Yeah.
Hey, we'll link to Natural Encounters and everything we've talked about today from the show notes. Steve, this has been so much fun. From myself and on behalf of the Animal Training Academy podcast audience, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan. Hope to see you again.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.